You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his latest book, Michael Lewis follows a very small group of Wall Street insiders, the skeptics and contrarians who bet against the boom and ended up profiting as the global financial market crashed. The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine, looks into the delusional thinking, blind greed, and at times fraudulent behavior that caused the subprime mortgage meltdown and the financial crisis. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Lewis back to our show. Hi, Michael.
Good to see you again.
Your first book, Liar's Poker, was also an insider's view of the financial world based on your own experiences at Salomon Brothers in the 1980s. I remember when you came here to talk about that. What strikes you when you look back at that time on Wall Street and compare it to what happened during the last decade?
I think you can see the seeds of what happened the last decade in the 1980s, or a lot of it anyway. When I got to Wall Street, the firms were just ceasing to be partnerships and becoming corporations. And that was a very big change because all of a sudden they were playing with other people's money. And I think that the sort of risks that the firms ended up taking during the subprime boom especially were risks that no partnership ever would have taken, that they would have looked much more closely at them.
Although they weren't doing things like subprime mortgage bonds and credit default swaps back then.
Well, they weren't. But on the other hand, again, the sort of the seeds of the innovation were there. The mortgage market was created on the Salomon Brothers trading floor in the late 70s, early 80s. So that whole world of taking loans and securitizing them has its roots there. And the credit default swap is an extension of financial options, which, again, was swept through the financial world in the 80s.
You did receive what you considered to be an inordinately large bonus at the time.
Which we're still talking about.
Well, how did it compare to what you might have received more recently?
Oh, my God. It's, you know, the sums I was paid look quaint now. I mean, when I was running around for the Big Short talking to people who were sort of the equivalent of me then now, and telling them what I made, they pitied me. They really thought what peanuts. But it was
six figures instead of the low seven figures.
Yeah, the first year into the business, it was a couple $100,000. But I was 25 years old. I couldn't believe people were throwing money at me this way.
And you didn't return it, even though you felt you didn't really earn it. Why did big bonuses become a part of the normal way of doing business on Wall Street?
Well, there was an internal logic to it. And the internal logic was that if you didn't pay the people who had made the money this year, they'd leave next year. And
go where?
Another Wall Street firm. It was that once the firms became corporations, free agency became the labor market became a free agent's labor market. The people weren't locked in because they didn't have big stakes in their firms. So that's the internal logic.
Didn't people leave anyway? I've heard of there was an awful lot of movement.
Oh no, there's still a lot of movement. But then there was, you know, it's like a really simple question: why are people paid so much on Wall Street? And it's a question that becomes even more pointed when you look at what happened, say, in 2007, when the bonuses were bigger than they ever were before, and yet the destruction of wealth was the biggest that it's ever been before. And so the question is: so how do these two things connect up? And it's very difficult to answer that question except in reference to when you start thinking about the way people start thinking about money when they're surrounded by a lot of other people who are making money. I mean, from the outside looking in, people on Wall Street, even when they're doing a good job, are ridiculously overpaid. The idea that they're getting paid this when they're doing a bad job is preposterous. But if you're sitting on a Wall Street trading floor, you're comparing yourself not to the wider world, but to the guy who sits next to you. And there's this competitive thing that, you know, yeah, I got paid $8 million last year, but Brian next to me got 8.5, and that's crazy. I should get 9. And that's the internal logic.
When you set out to write this new book, did you know that you wanted to focus on the financial skeptics who saw that the crash was coming?
Not immediately. I suppose the first glimmer of an idea I had that I might write a book about this came in 2007, when it was clear that the Wall Street firms had become the dumb money, that they had actually kind of that they ended up along a lot of these subprime mortgage securities, and I was curious why, how that happened. Because it used to be, when I was on the Salomon Brothers trading floor, you did not want to be on the other side of a trade from Salomon Brothers. If you were on the other side of the trade, you were going to lose. And if it was a zero-sum type trade. And all of a sudden, there were zero-sum type trades that the Wall Street firms were on the wrong end of. And that's what got me interested in the first place. And I guess it should have been a natural extension of that, that I was going to write the book about the people who are on the right end and how they got on the right end.
And how do you find those people? Just simply look to who made money when everybody else was losing money?
Yes. Well, that was the first way. You go to, you know, you go to things like hedge fund rankings, returns and rankings in 2007 when the markets were falling apart, and anybody who was short the subprime mortgage market made a fortune in 2007. So that was the way I started in. And then I did a kind of casting search. I went around and tried to basically meet everybody who had made this curious bet, this bet against that market, and get a sense of who would be representative. Who would be most educational? Who the reader could follow and actually learn why all this happened?
Although it is interesting that so many Wall Streeters now claim that they saw it coming.
Do they? You know, that's funny because I thought that the common response, especially from the Wall Street leadership, is no one saw it coming. You hear this out of the ratings agencies. You hear this from former and current Wall Street CEOs. This sort of tsunami swept over us, and so since nobody saw it coming, we can't be held accountable for not seeing it coming. But the truth is, some people actually did see it coming, and it was seeable.
They saw it coming, and they did nothing about it because that's the way. Because you were working for the company, and you were doing your job.
Yes, and because there was so much money to be made from not seeing it. I mean, you know, I think that one of the lessons of the story is it's a story of human perception. People see what they're paid to see. And when you're paid vast sums of money not to see what's right under your nose, it's amazing how you won't see what's right under your nose.
My guest is Michael Lewis, whose latest book is called The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. It is published by Norton. The story you tell revolves mostly around the mortgage bond market. We know what it's led to, but how did it get started?
The original mortgage bond market?
Yeah, I mean, how is it a mortgage bond different from other corporate or government bonds?
Well, in many ways, but in its origins, the big problem with mortgage bonds, for the point of view of the people who are packing to get the mortgage loan underneath the mortgage bond, was that the homeowner had the ability to repay it whenever he wanted to repay it, and how to deal with that option was a problem. And the way the mortgage bond market dealt with it was by creating tranches. You pile together these loans, and the people who take the risk of getting repaid soonest get the highest interest rate. Which in retrospect, again, seems quaint because the fear when the mortgage bond market was created was not that these things were not going to pay off. It was that you get paid too soon, that the loans that got securitized were federally backed or federally guaranteed loans, basically, or government agency guaranteed loans. And it morphed. It morphed into a market that piled up in under these securities, subprime mortgage loans, where the risk is not getting paid too soon, but not getting paid at all.
Is this kind of like what happens with credit cards, where the credit card companies really don't like the people who pay off their card every month, but obviously when they have too many people who don't pay them off at all, they wind up in serious trouble?
Yeah, well, it is the same calculation, isn't it? I mean, the reason you don't want to get paid off early when you're a mortgage bondholder is that you're getting paid off early because interest rates have fallen and the homeowners are refinancing. And so you're given money that you have to reinvest at lower interest rates. So that's the logic there. It sounds counterintuitive, but it makes sense.
You're right that the growing interface between high finance and lower middle class America was assumed to be good for lower middle class America. Why? Why was it assumed to be good? And was that the intention of subprime lending when it started in the 1990s, to do good for lower middle class America?
Just to back up a second, it is really interesting how this interface has expanded, because if you go back historically, Wall Street was really only involved with the asset side of the American balance sheet. If you had assets, you might want to invest them in the stock market, and for that you might talk to your friendly or unfriendly Wall Street broker. The minute that that loans began to be securitized into bonds, then all of a sudden Wall Street start looking at America's liabilities and dealing with their debts. And what happened from the 1980s until now is that it crept further and further down the social structure and dealt with people whose debts were more and more precarious. And it was assumed in the argument in the very beginning of the subprime market, not the 2003 and 4 and 5 version of the subprime market, but in the 1990s, was that that middle class and lower middle class Americans who were increasingly incurring high interest-bearing credit card loans had this asset, their house. And you could give them at a lower interest cost a loan against their house that it would enable them to pay off all their other loans, and so the cost of their debt would go down. And that was the rationale in the
sounds idealistic.
Well, it was, you know, and I think not implausible. I mean, there was a very plausible story that it made much more sense to borrow against your asset than just to borrow naked and at a much higher interest rate.
But people weren't paying off their credit, their loans, and
people were just using it as an excuse to go further and further into debt.
One major figure in your book is Steve Eisman. How did he get started on Wall Street?
Steve Eisman is one of the three main characters, and Steve Eisman was an unhappy lawyer. He'd just come out of law school, hated being a lawyer, and he had his mom and dad worked at a firm called Oppenheimer. And he says, as ugly as it is, that's the truth of it is that even though I'd gone to the Harvard Law School, my mom and dad got me a job on Wall Street. And he got a job he was called a junior analyst, but basically he was a step and fetch it. And the subprime mortgage business in the 1990s was just starting, and nobody knew anything about these companies. He was handed a file on one of the first ones and told to analyze it, and that's how he started.
He's one of the good guys in this book, although you write that his own wife describes him as rude and obnoxious and aggressive. Are these personality traits that work well on Wall Street?
Yes, they are. Well, his old wife said, it's even better. I think she said, I know he's rude. I know my husband's rude. I've tried everything. There's nothing I can do about it. Generally, they actually aren't traits that work well in the big Wall Street firms. The firms have become increasingly corporate, increasingly political operations, and someone who knows to kind of glad hand and go along and get along does much better than someone who's rude and obnoxious and always telling you the truth you don't want to hear.
Well, he was hired to deal with subprime mortgage lending, and I'm assuming initially he was very much in support of it. It's what he was supposed to do.
Yes, he saw the point. He believed the story that this was actually going to be a useful tool for Americans to manage their finances. He thought these companies made sense, the original subprime originators, and he was one of the two or three original leading analysts of these companies, and he brought a lot of these companies to market in the first place. And he was, on the other hand, he was also someone who unusually for a sell-side analyst, would say negative things about companies. So he was, right from the get-go, willing to be a little unpopular.
And then he hired Vincent Daniel. And we will take a little break and come back to what Vincent Daniel did and more as we continue this conversation with Michael Lewis, the best-selling author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, The Blind Side, Home Game, his latest, the one we're discussing, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine, which is published by Norton. We're back with Michael Lewis, whose latest book is The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine, published by Norton. We were talking about Steve Eisman, who is a lawyer. He started wondering about subprime mortgage lending, and then he hired Vincent Daniel, an accountant, to help him figure out what mortgage-backed securities were. Because he realized this was too complicated for him?
Well, you know, as Eisenman says, I can't add. You know, he says he can't do math. He's a conceptual person, kind of a storyteller in a way.
But he must have known enough to know that he needed this help.
Well, this was interesting. He started to sense something. These early subprime mortgage lenders in the late 90s, he started to sense something was wrong with the business. But he didn't have the numbers to back up an argument, and Moody's had just started to produce data on their loans, on the quality of their loans, and the performance of their loans, and so he hired someone who was comfortable with numbers, Vincent Daniel, to come in and work with him and tell him what the numbers were saying, and at the end of a several month process, Eisenman writes a report saying all these companies are going to be worth zero one day soon. And creates turmoil in the marketplace. But what was interesting about this is what had happened in between, that he goes from being sort of kind of a happy cynic to being a really dark and gloomy pessimist about this industry that he covers. But in between, something really important had happened to him. His wife had given birth to their first child, and the child was killed as an infant. And his wife, who had been in the business, had worked at J.P. Morgan, said, it changed my husband's outlook towards his own work, that he always believed sort of things sort of worked out, and even if he was a little cynical. And he turned into someone who was sort of prepared to believe really bad things could happen in the world.
But this wasn't even just theoretical. He knew people, his housekeeper and his kid's former baby nurse, who were getting these kinds of loans.
Well, this was later. In the second iteration, in the 2000s, he starts seeing people he knows getting given these loans they shouldn't be given, and he knows that this industry's come roaring back, and it's not going to work out well.
Well, if he was seeing this, how come other people weren't seeing it?
Well, this is the great question, right? You've got this the entire financial system organized itself in retrospect around this bet, and the vast majority of the system was betting on subprime mortgage loans working out, and yet only a tiny handful of people were on the other side. Why was it only a tiny handful? What was it about them? And I think it gets back to what you're paid to see, and how people are prepared to see the world.
But the ratings companies are paid to see this, and you say he was using data from Moody's. Moody's and Standard & Poor's were looking at all of these figures, and yet they were giving these things AAA ratings. They're about to give, I think, was it Standard & Poor's I read in the paper today, is going to give the U.S. government less than a AAA now.
Moody's was talking about how the U.S. government is moving closer to losing its AAA rating, which is kind of obvious. I mean, but broadly, what just happened in America was a great credit laundering scheme that we have a society that is living beyond its means and a lot of individuals in it who are living beyond their means. There was an obvious appetite for loans that should have been never have been made. There was an awful lot of money to be made from making those loans and packaging those loans and selling those loans off in the form of bonds and derivatives of the bonds. And someone needed to disguise the risk for all this happened, because when you make loans that are shaky loans, there's a huge amount of risk. And the system evolved in a very complicated way to disguise the risk. And the punchline of the story, though, is that it disguised the risk even from the Wall Street firms that end up taking a lot of the risk, that they sort of ended up believing their own lie. But the mechanism by which this risk was disguised was, well, it's my story. I mean, Eisenman and two or three other people trying to figure out how on earth this is happening is really the story.
And another one of those is Michael Burry, the investor that was featured on last Sunday's 60 Minutes segment about your book. He didn't want to buy mortgage bonds like everybody else was doing, but instead wanted to short subprime mortgage bonds.
Yes.
What does that mean exactly?
To bet on the price falling. Technically, you're borrowing something you don't own to sell it. But in this case...
And was the mechanism in place for him to be able to do that?
It wasn't when he had the idea to do it, because the problem with subprime mortgage bonds, unlike, say, IBM stock, is that each one is peculiar. And there's very small amounts of each one. And it's so you can't find them to borrow them. You need to borrow them to be able to sell them if you don't own them. So what happened was Wall Street invented a way to short these things, and the invention was called a credit default swap. And it's insurance. You're buying insurance on the bond. So you pay a premium to the person who sells you the insurance, and you get paid in full if the bond collapses.
And that cost Wall Street an awful lot of money too.
Well, it was essentially what arose on the side of legitimate finance was a casino in credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. It was a huge zero-sum game that, in retrospect, was very, very destructive.
We have this little guy who actually winds up, in effect, creating credit default swaps, and he's not even on Wall Street.
He's in San Jose, and he's not even really he's not of Wall Street. He's a neurologist who's a resident at Stanford University Hospital, who is dropped out of medicine because his blog postings on investing have attracted such attention that he's got money to create a hedge fund, and so he's got what he is at heart. And this is the thing that's so tragic: is at heart what he is a value stock market investor. He really wants to be Warren Buffett. That's his hero. And he gets into the business to find undervalued companies and bet on them, and discovers that he can't, in good conscience, make stock market investments without dealing with this weird event that's happening in the bond markets.
But at one point in 2007, he seemed like a Wall Street villain.
I would go even further than that. From about 2006, after he's been in this bet against the subprime mortgage market for a year, he's a villain to his own investors, that the people who've given him money are outraged that he's got this bet on. His own employees doubt what he's doing.
Because he's going against what everybody else is
saying. Because everybody else is saying this thing, you're predicting the unpredictable. And he's making a very cogent argument about why actually this is a predictable crash. And he's making it in letters in a weird way. The problem is that he was making it in print in his letters to his investors, and not face to face. He has Asperger's syndrome. He doesn't know he has Asperger's syndrome, which makes it even more complicated. But he loathes sort of social interaction, and so he's not having it. He's writing these things, assuming people are reading them, and he pretty quickly figures out though after that nobody's reading them, and they're seeing. They're seeing the bets he's making or the short-term results from these bets, and they're furious. He's squandering their money on insurance premiums.
They would have preferred being with Bernie Madoff, I'm sure.
That's an interesting point. But many of them, I'm sure, would have, because Bernie Madoff would have been showing these great returns.
Although in the end, they wound up doing very well. Michael Lewis's latest book is called The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Almost everybody's villain still is Goldman Sachs. Do they deserve to be as vilified as they've been?
Yes. They weren't alone, but Goldman Sachs, I think, did some bad things. And
They also bet the same way that Barry did, didn't they?
They turned around and bet against a market they helped create. That's true. They got out at the last minute. They weren't as smart as, I think, in general, they seem in the popular press, although the popular press has been pretty good about Goldman Sachs, especially the Times. But they were long the subprime mortgage market well after it should have crashed. But they got out just before the other Wall Street firms didn't turn around that way. But one of the original sins in this market is the relationship between Goldman Sachs and AIG. I mean, there's not insurance available to buy on subprime mortgage markets unless someone's willing to sell it. And the first big seller is AIG. And the reason they're willing to sell it is Goldman Sachs talks them into doing the business. And in very short order, in kind of March 2005, the financial markets changed radically quickly because Goldman Sachs persuaded AIG to insure $20 billion of subprime mortgage-backed pools. And the riskiest layer of those pools, and that created the business. I mean, if that doesn't happen, I think you get a different financial history. And the question I have is not whether it was illegal for them to do this, because it wasn't. You know, that they, you know, it's, the bond market is a poisonous game, and you're sort of, it's sort of assumed that when Goldman Sachs comes calling with some bond deal, you ought to be, you have the obligation to be careful. And so AIG should never have done this business. But nevertheless, essentially in a stroke, Goldman put risk that it knew was really dangerous risk in such size into that insurance company that it was going to blow the place up. And why someone senior at Goldman Sachs did not stop the traders from doing that, I do not understand. Because it was, it was a violent act, I think. And we, and you know, one of the interesting facts that's going to be really useful to know, that I assume will come out of maybe the Financial Inquiry Commission in Washington, is what actually happened between the Goldman Sachs salesperson who was talking AIG into doing this business and the person on the AIG end who later claimed he actually didn't know what he had done, that it didn't understand that they had insured not diversified pools of assets but pools exclusively of subprime mortgage bonds.
Is that guy a hero at Goldman Sachs?
He was known as the Grim Reaper around Goldman Sachs, and I think that's a term of endearment.
Now, the third person you profile here is Greg Lipman. He seems to know all the other people who are seeing through what's going on.
Lipman is a really interesting character, and he's an interesting – Greg Lipman is a trader at Deutsche Bank until 2 weeks from now. I think he's leaving Deutsche Bank. But he's a trader who's a subprime mortgage bond trader and has been one – or an asset-backed trader, they call them, who's been one for more than a decade. When all this happens. And he's the first person inside a big Wall Street firm to cry foul, to say this market is crazy and we should be short it, not long it. And he fails to persuade the people inside Deutsche Bank, the various people who might be betting on subprime mortgage bonds. He himself makes a big bet against them, but he fails to persuade his colleagues. And he regards the market as this giant tug of war between the people who know that it's a disaster and the people who don't. And he runs around the world trying to get people to join him to pull on his end of the rope. And he makes a, in retrospect, flawless argument about why you should be short this market. And in retrospect, what's so interesting is how few people listen to it. And why? And why is because the bond market is like the used car market. Nobody believes anybody coming out of one of these Wall Street firms. And when they come out of the Wall Street firms with what seems like a get-rich-quick scheme, the first reaction of a professional investor is there must be something wrong with this.
What about people's personalities? Because recently I spoke to Harry Markopoulos, the man who blew the whistle on Bernie Madoff, and nobody paid any attention. And it occurred to me that he has a slightly abrasive personality, and I suspect that when he came to people, they took a certain disliking to him. And so no matter what he said, was not taken as seriously as it should. We're talking about some other people here, rather abrasive, including one of them, who Eisman, who moves to the left politically in an industry where everybody is rather conservative.
Yeah, no, Eisman's journey is a riveting one because he starts as a pretty right-wing Republican. He's a college Republican. He arrives on Wall Street a Republican. By the time he's done, he's almost a socialist. It's hard to think of many people who drift left in their politics at that age in that industry. But he's drifting left because he's observing this interaction between the financial people and ordinary people on the streets.
And that Michael Burry is not the most sociable person.
No, your point is well taken. And the point is that
these are all outsiders.
They're all outsiders, and they're all squeaky wheels. And squeaky wheels had no place in the machine.
What about Cornwall Capital, the hedge fund that made a lot of money because of the collapse of Bear Stearns?
Yes, you know, the question I was always asking myself is why was it these people were able to see what they saw? What was it in them that the financial system could have used more of in order to prevent the crisis? And squeaky wheels is one answer. People who are willing to speak unpleasant truths. But this was another answer. The Cornwall capital guys are perfectly pleasant. They're delightful. So they're well-mannered. They don't offend people. But they had a theory about financial markets. I mean, they started out as guys literally in a garage in Berkeley, California with $100,000 in a Schwab account and with no experience, professional investment experience. But they thought that that Wall Street just generally underestimated the likelihood of extreme things happening, and they thought Wall Street priced options that you could buy on extreme events too low, that Wall Street was in effect, the markets were in effect too certain about their ability to predict what was going to happen, and too complacent about the likelihood of catastrophes. And so they systematically go out and buy what are called out-of-the-money options, way out-of-the-money long-term options on various forms of, well, not just catastrophe, but also good catastrophes, miracles, and on currencies and commodities and stocks. And while it's like putting bets on double zero on a roulette table, but the roulette wheel is rigged to come up double zero more than it should. And that's what happens. They lose more often than they win, but when they win big. And they turn, over a period of a couple of years, $100,000 becomes $15 million. And then they discover the credit default swap on the subprime mortgage bond, which is the ultimate double zero bet. It's like putting your chips on double zero, but the odds of it coming up are better than even.
Have you looked at the proposals for reform?
No, in the sense that I haven't read Chris Dodd's bill, but I've seen generally what he's proposing to do. And the headlines make total sense to me in that the general objectives of what he says he's trying to achieve make total sense. I have no ability to evaluate now whether how he's intending to achieve them will achieve them.
You do suggest that Wall Street as we know it is almost doomed to fail or change or...
It's an unsustainable structure. Mm-hmm. The financial industry...
So what's going to happen?
I think one way or another the firms are going to get broken up. They're going to be smaller...
So they'll be too small to fail?
What they'd say is too small to succeed. But I think that they are right now pretty clearly counterproductive enterprises. And they're out of sync with the rest of the society and the economy. And I think politically now people become aware of that.
Michael Lewis's latest book is The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.